For those of you that don't know where I work for a theological institution called St. Mark's. And in the last 5 years of working with them, I've been participating in their chapel service during the term. So from Tuesdays to Fridays now, they do chapel for 15 minutes, morning prayer. And they do it Anglican style. So we have a short chapel service, and then I go in there and I do the whole stand up, sit down, read response thing. It took a bit of getting used to. I didn't grow up with lectionaries. Growing up in that denomination, Churches of Christ, we had our own, don't call it tradition, but only on Sundays and not during the week. And in congregations around the globe, my former denomination's church service included about five a cappella hymns and maybe some contemporary Christian choruses from the 1990s. So this Australian Anglican format was seriously distracting to me for a while. I mean, I go along, but I really struggled some days to get into it. I'd read the half verses out loud, but not really taking what I was reciting because I'm trying not to overshoot my reading portion. In fact, some days it got a little bit stressful when they were like, "And now let's just flip to the end and then read this other, you know." They had different parts and it'll flip through the parts of the prayer book, and I'm just wasn't used to it because I didn't grow up Anglican. But it was, you know, I've worked there for 5 years, and it was only this year, maybe like last month, one really quiet Wednesday morning when we hardly had any students, when it really suddenly hit me that I was part of a ritual that millions of Christians have shared in and share in. That as I recite the Lord's Prayer, which Dave just quoted, and now I've memorized it word for word, and therefore it's digestible and meaningful again. I was doing this with tens of thousands of others in a sort of unison through time. And in other words, it really suddenly hit me that I was in communion with others who may not think exactly like I do about God, but who confess a faith in and a need for Christ. I was not alone, but among many, many, many. It's often said that Jesus ate his way through the Gospels. I love that. I love how God mingled with us, ate and drank and burped with us, and then made seriously quality plonk because his human mother told him to. I love how God constantly uses the dining table as a prime example of how to include others. From the Old Testament to the New, we're told to fold in the foreigner into God's doughy family by breaking bread with them. In the Glanville's Brothers book, Refuge Reimagined, which a few of us actually got together and studied and with the authors, which was awesome, they dedicated the first few chapters to the understanding of the concept of kinship. And I learned through that book that ancient pilgrimage feasts often functioned as a way of breaking down traditional social structures and hierarchies. So the stranger becomes a guest, becomes a friend. When done right, eating together humbles the powerful and elevates the vulnerable. And through such a simple, universal act of setting aside time to eat and drink in community, we remember our shared and common humanity. So, of course, as humans, we're also very good at finding reasons to keep people at arm's length, particularly people who, on the outset, are collectively different to ourselves. Now, I'm slightly nervous now because I'm about to dive into Jeff's favorite book, but here goes. I haven't heard sermons about this one yet, but it might just be that I missed them. So apologies in advance if I'm repeating stuff that you've already heard. Two-thirds of the way into the book of Luke, in chapter 14, Jesus gets invited as a dinner guest to a Pharisee leader's house. Now, it's a common practice in those days in that part of the woods. A traveling preacher or rabbi passes through town, and the religious leaders invite him for dinner, followed by a light digestif, you know, interrogation on his politics and theology. So Jesus turns up and watches as these Pharisees all jostle for prominence near the host seats. And then he uses this as a teaching moment and opens with a parable suggesting that those who lift themselves up will be brought low and vice versa. And then he turns to the guy that invited him to this dinner and says, by the way, when you host a meal, don't invite your friends, your brothers and sisters, your relatives or rich neighbors, because then they will invite you back and your deed will be rewarded. Instead, invite the poor and vulnerable because they can't repay you. And at this moment, one of the dinner guests pipes up and goes, happy are those who feast in God's kingdom. And while that contribution feels random, or maybe like a desperate diversion after all that speak truth to power awkwardness, it actually has a lot to do with a then 700-year-old conversation in the book of Isaiah. Now, in chapter 25 of Isaiah, Isaiah dreams of a great banquet to be held at the end of history, in which the Lord of hosts spreads the banquet and serves the food of kings. The feast venue is on the holy mountain of the Lord, and the guests will include people from all the Gentile nations. Death is swallowed up, tears are wiped, and his people's disgrace will be removed from the earth. It will be a glorious day of salvation. And this banquet in Isaiah has been henceforth known as the Messianic Banquet. But guess what? Since Isaiah's dream, which is controversial because it included all the Gentile nations, history started to get a little bit, you know, helped along or revised. The Targum, which is an Aramaic paraphrase and interpretation of the Hebrew scriptures, took enough liberties with this Isaiah text to actually change its meaning completely. The Targum reads, Yahweh of hosts will make for all the peoples of this mountain a meal. So far, so good. But then it continues to say, although they supposed it an honor, it will be a shame for them, and great plagues from which they will be unable to escape, plagues whereby they will come to their end. About the same time in second century BC, the book of Enoch came out, and it too speaks of a great banquet with the Messiah and even affirms that the Gentiles will be included. But then they throw in the angel of death out of nowhere and then got him to carve up all these Gentiles with his sword and then fill the banquet hall with so much blood, the believers will have to, wait for it, wade through the gore to reach the banquet table where they get to sit down with the Messiah. Among the Qumran community, they just went down the road of flat-out denial. They refused to acknowledge that any Gentiles will be present at this banquet. And not only Gentiles, but those who are smitten in his flesh, or paralyzed with his feet or hands, or lame, or blind, or deaf, or dumb, or smitten in his flesh with a visible blemish. Hello. That outburst from random diner about happy are those who feast in God's kingdom isn't a non sequitur, but a challenge to Jesus to voice his views on how he thinks God's kingdom is going to shake down and who the Messiah is. It's a reaction brought on by Jesus' suggestion that the last should be first and the first the last. And so Jesus answered by telling the parable of a man hosting a huge dinner party where all his invited guests fob him off. It ends with the host bringing in the poor, crippled, blind, and lame. It ends with the host declaring, go to the highways and back alleys and urge people to come in so that my house will be filled. I tell you, not one of those who were invited will taste my dinner. I don't know about you, but my heart has been especially heavy of late, like Natalie and Jonathan were just talking about. Just all the stuff that's happening in the world, whether it's other Australian states erupting in violent and self-defeating protests, or watching desperate people fall to their deaths from a departing plane, or a years-long mass starvation exacerbated by devastating fire, or national economies imploding, or ancient feuds exploding, or an impoverished nation hit by another earthquake, or systemic genocide, or close neighbors overrun with disease and crippled by their own poverty and rampant corruption. Or maybe it's much closer to home, a business you love that's dying from lockdown, an 18-day-old baby who just contracted COVID, a friend living in a corner of her house in constant fear of her life-sucking abuser. I know it's been terrible before. I know the world has seen through other shitstorms formed by a confluence of terrible world events and natural disasters. But it still grieves the heart until there are not enough good words. They're just not enough words. Probably the biggest frustration has been to watch a pandemic expose so thoroughly our shared humanity, only for us to insist on splintering from each other anyway. My greatest challenge hasn't been the numbness to the vulnerable or grieving with those who mourn. My greatest challenge has been dealing with dark disappointment and a seething anger towards those who don't think or feel like me on a long raft of issues, who also happen to profess Christ as Lord. I've lamented several times this week that I believe in Jesus, but I really don't care for his fan club lately. It's very un-John of me, but it's true. No matter how innocuous and well-intentioned the Christian forum I wander into, eventually someone will say something about communist lefties and heartless conservatives not being really Christian enough. And then the arrows start to fly and I just want out. Even though I have strong opinions, I just want out. I'm so over it. I don't want to break bread with these people. I don't want to tamp down high-pitched screaming about vaccines and masks and refugees and fake news and abortion and climate change and male supremacy. There are days I don't even know how to feel about identifying as Christian. Is there another title, I wonder? One that doesn't immediately conjure a horrible cliche I'm thoroughly sick of but secretly suspect I fulfill to a T. But you see, I'm invited to a large dinner party and the table is open to everyone, everyone. And I should be glad I even made the guest list at all. We're often quite focused on the Last Supper that Jesus had with his closest friends. We know the accounts very well, those of us who have been doing this for a while, that on the night, and it's probably during their Passover feast, in fact it is, Jesus took the most ordinary food items, universally accessible and recognizable. He took bread and wine. And from there, he created a new meal ritual, so simple in its execution, so extraordinary and touchy in its significance. We're focused on this Last Supper, but the term Last Supper also implies a whole series of previous suppers. As renewing as it is to remember Jesus' resurrection, the Lord's Supper harks back to a very ancient message that the kingdom is about feasting and the feasting is open to every nation. And that no church, no denomination, no individual is an island. We can fool ourselves into thinking that we're a very special remnant who really get Jesus, but the net that's cast is much wider and the table is set far bigger than we might imagine. So in the same way, it recently dawned on me that the Anglican liturgy plugged me into a much bigger body of people. So the Lord's Supper brings me into communion with believers the world over who confess Christ as King. It's not just a local thing. This ritual is ancient and sacred and simple and profound. And it really speaks to kinship. And it's not just about folding in the stranger from the outside. It's also about looking at those on the inside whose behavior and convictions are downright alien to mine and then realizing I am already in communion with them whether I like it or not. The Lord's Supper foreshadows how grand, how gracious the ultimate feast is going to be. Happy are those who feast in God's kingdom. At this time, for those of us who've found some beverage that might substitute for juice or wine or maybe real wine. And if you have a bicky handy, I'd like to take us through Matthew quite quickly and just read that verse again. Matthew 26. And it's the Passover. And on the first day of the festival of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat this Passover meal?" And Jesus replied, "Go into the city to a certain man and say, 'The teacher says, my time is near. I'm going to celebrate the Passover with my disciples at your house.' The disciples did just as Jesus instructed them. They prepared the Passover. And that evening," and bear in mind, Jesus, who has probably had countless of meals of these, his best friends by now, and he knows this is the last gig, right? This is the last get together. This is the last meal before it just all goes downhill. He says, as they were eating, "I assure you that one of you will betray me." Deeply saddened, each of them said to him, "I'm not the one, my Lord." And Jesus replied, "The one who will betray me is the one who dips his hand with me into this bowl. The human one goes to his death, just as it is written about him. But how terrible it is for that person who betrays the human one. It would have been better for him if he had never been born." Now Judas, who would betray him, replied, "It's not me, is it, Rabbi?" And Jesus answered, "You said it." And I think about the fact that Jesus, fully knowing that Judas, what Judas had done, communed with him anyway, loved him anyway, fed him anyway, broke bread with him anyway. When they were eating, Jesus took bread. He blessed it, he broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, "Take and eat. This is my body." He took a cup, gave thanks, and gave it to them, saying, "Drink from this, all of you. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for so many so that their sins may be forgiven. I tell you, I won't drink wine again until the day when I drink it in a new way with you in my Father's kingdom." And then after singing songs of praise, they went to the Mount of Olives. Let's take this time to just have a moment of silence and share in with the emblems as we meditate on this.